Ending the show today with Air Coach, new Sunday's reissue of Prism. I can't find a place, or maybe it's the first issue, I don't know. Will Veer before that, God is the Devil from The Lost and Found. Yossi Letisalo, that is Yossi from Circle, from a new record called Electric Catapult. We heard excerpts from Flaming Wonderful. Masami Makino before that, an excerpt from When Icarus Dies, a new thing called Omoya Houses for the Blue Meditation. If, When, before that, prelude to a record called A Wide Space Variable. Thanks, Greg from Zone 5, for sending that our way. 33 has a new one, Love Changes Everything. We heard Love Changes Everything 5. And we heard Moon Unit at the top of the set with The Solar Skull from 2010's Hell Horse and Hetty Stratus. Scott here. Thanks for hanging with me today, friends. Look forward to seeing you next week. Mark Hurst is right here. He's coming right up with Tectonic right here on WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City in Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Bye.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, in downtown Jersey City in that great state. That's New Jersey, by the way. I'm so happy to be here with you this evening. Thanks for joining me. We're going to be talking with novelist Helen Phillips about her new novel, that is called Hum. That's spelled H-U-M. Hum. And it's in all caps for whatever that may mean. I enjoyed the read, as you'll hear in the interview. And after the interview, I think we're going to have some time to talk about some of the connections between this notional dystopian world depicted in Hum and some recent experiences that I had that fit right into the ethos that is described in Helen Phillips' work. Now, let's talk about hum for a little bit, because I've covered novels and interviewed novelists in the past, and the challenge with an interview about a novel is that you want to expose the themes of the book and talk about some of the details of the book without giving away spoilers. So I think we did a pretty good job in this interview, but I do want to give you a little bit of a setup. This book, as I said, written by Helen Phillips. She's based in Brooklyn, and the novel is set across several days in a city that looks and feels a lot like New York. And she'll speak to that later in the interview. And this city is just full of surveillance cameras, full of addictive mobile devices, full of AI. In fact, there are embodied AIs in the form of robots that themselves are called hums, which we'll talk about. And there are many instances in the book of accelerating climate change. So all of this is swirling together, and you have this family, this mother and father and two kids who are navigating their daily life in this city. And as I was reading this book, I'm thinking, this is not too far off from the reality that we already have in New York and in other cities, which made it, there's a bit of an uncanny similarity, or I guess familiarity, in the experiences that Phillips writes about to the experiences that you may be accustomed to in your city, whether New York or elsewhere. So with that as a little bit of a heads up, I want to go ahead and get to this interview. And if you'd like to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlists and comments, and you can join in. And with that, friends, let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Helen Phillips here on Tectonic on WFMU. Helen Phillips, welcome to Tectonic.
It is an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure thing. Helen, you've written several books, and your newest has just been released. It's a novel called Hum. The story has some elements of what I would call dystopian sci-fi, though the themes go well past that. The events of the novel take place over the course of a few days in a city that I describe as New York in the not-too-distant future. We see robots and handheld devices and conversational AI that are all well past what we have today. So just to start us off, Helen, how did you go about this world-building process?
Well, as you've pointed out, it is not a totally unfamiliar setting, though it is an alternate reality, you could say. One reviewer said the novel feels as though it's set 5 minutes in the future. And indeed, I did seed a lot of what is in the book from our present moment. So it's a kind of contra-present, you could say. And in developing the world of the book, I did a huge amount of research. I read books about climate change, including The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells. I read books about artificial intelligence. My personal favorite was Arthur I. Miller's book, The Artist and the Machine, which is actually a more positive view of human AI creative collaborations. I read Sherry Turkle's book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, and a lot of other books and articles. And these writers are all really thinking about the future in important ways. And as I was crafting Hum, I wanted to engage with those other minds that were thinking about the future. So a lot of the ideas in the book were inspired by that research I did.
I noticed at the end of the book, you've got an end notes section, which one doesn't usually see at the end of novels. And I appreciated you sharing the sources for some of the quotes, which is to say you have characters and in a couple of cases, robots who are giving certain quotes that you lifted from interviews or other sources that you found online. And then the endnotes finish with a section called Other Works Read, and that included the books that you were just mentioning. It was nice to see a couple of past Tectonic guests in that list as well, Douglas Rushkoff and Kashmir Hill, as well as John Ronson, who spoke at a Skeptech event we had downstairs at Monty Hall a few years ago. So you clearly did your homework. You did your research to learn what the state of technology and its effects on society are now. I wanted to ask, as you were writing the book, were there any developments that you invented that you were thinking might come to pass in the future that actually did come true while you were writing the book?
Yes, it is quite odd to be a writer of speculative or science fiction or futuristic fiction right now, because the present moment does tend to catch up with your imagination. So when I started researching the book and thinking about it in the fall of 2019, there were articles out about the precursors to ChatGPT. But of course, ChatGPT is much more recent than 2019. So that was one thing that I was thinking a lot about when I was writing the early drafts of the book, super advanced AI systems like ChatGPT, and then that did indeed come to pass. Another thing that felt like that was I had done research related to climate change that really emphasized air quality, and David Wallace Wells does in his book, The Uninhabitable Earth. And then last June of 2023, in our area of New York City and the surrounding areas, we had air quality of 450 because of the wildfires that were burning elsewhere. So that was another moment where the reality caught up to my book and my imagination.
Oh, I definitely noticed that as I read Hum. The air quality is a constant concern of the characters who we'll get to, and they're talking about AQI. And I read that and I thought, oh, she's referring to the Ontario wildfires of June 2023. But no, actually, it came in your research beforehand as something that could come to pass.
Yes, the book was finished before those wildfires happened.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's the life of a dystopian novelist, I guess.
I fear it is.
You're based in this area. You teach at Brooklyn College. And the book, I thought, really captures the feel of New York City today, post-pandemic. Even though we're talking about it being in the future, a lot of the aspects that you're writing about are totally familiar to my experience walking around the city today. People stuck on their devices, advertising screens everywhere, gig workers scrambling for jobs, and generally the excesses and harms of the digital world spilling over into day-to-day life. I wanted to ask, Helen, how much of the book was your own reaction to your experience of living in New York City today?
Well, the book is not explicitly set in New York City. It is an unnamed city. And that was important to me to maintain that flexibility to some extent with the location. But you're right. It does have many scenes that would be familiar to a lot of New Yorkers, including certain subway scenes and certain Gowanus Canal type scenes. I feel like as a writer, wherever I am seeps into me and comes forth in the work in some form. And I think that would probably be true wherever I lived, that landscape influences you. But I am a very image-based writer. And so an image, for instance, of a group of pigeons pecking at some chicken wings that someone left on the sidewalk appears in the book. And yes, that is an image of our beloved New York. I love New York tremendously.
Let's talk about family, which is a major theme of Hum. The main character is a woman named Mae Webb, who has just lost her job, and she's, for the moment, dependent on her husband, Jem, J-E-M, who's a gig worker. Mae and Jem have two kids, a son and a daughter, and together, the four of them, the interactions between these four family members are central to the book. This, I think, is a somewhat unique aspect of Hum versus some other dystopian sci-fi people might read, in that You're making a statement about the importance of family in a tech-saturated society.
Yes, I do think that for me, on a personal level, a lot of my concerns about an interaction with tech occur in a very intimate space, the space of my home, of my relationship, of my motherhood. I want that to be a bigger part of the conversation, how tech is influencing these most private, personal, intimate relationships. So when I was writing the book, I really wanted to examine, okay, what is it like if everyone is staring at their phone during dinner? What is it like if the children wear on their wrists these things that in my book are called bunnies, which are these watches that essentially connect them to the internet and even serve as little robot therapists for them? This is an exaggeration of the world we live in, but what does it do to our intimacy with each other when there's always a robot or an artificial intelligence or a screen that is offering us what it thinks that we want?
Yeah, there's a couple of scenes in the book where a robot shows up. We're going to get to the robots in one minute, but on this point of the intimacy and the relationships that people have, a robot shows up and says something to the kids, and the kids instinctively gravitate toward the robot. In one case, one of the kids says to the robot, "I love you," which is not something that you hear them say to their parents. And that, I think, might be a somewhat familiar phenomenon for some parents who might have trouble communicating with the kids, whereas the kids seem much more interested in giving their attention and even their affection to digital devices and personalities.
Yes, I would again mention Sherry Turkle's book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, which was published in 2015, but still feels very relevant to our current moment. In it, she talks about the ease with which humans can attribute empathy and caring to robots. We really are, it's almost like we're evolutionarily wired to, if another consciousness is taking us seriously, responding to us, reflecting us back at ourselves, whether it's a human or a robot, we are really able to attribute empathy to that figure. And so I was thinking about that a lot when I was writing.
I don't know if Turkle mentioned Eliza, the original chatbot from MIT in the 70s.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. That is in Turkle's book. It's also in Clifford A. Pickover's book, which was another resource for me. So this was an early chatbot. And from my understanding and my reading, basically it just recycled back to you whatever you said to it. So it was a very primitive chatbot compared to what we have now. But the researcher was astonished about the ease with which people came to really feel that the robot was caring for them, even this simple chatbot that was truly only just reiterating what they had said to it.
Yeah, the researcher was Joseph Weizenbaum, who was a professor at MIT back in those days. And he would even tell the users before they fired up Eliza, "Look, this thing is just a few lines of code. Don't take it too seriously." And they'd say, "Could you please give me some space? I want to talk to Eliza." And Weizenbaum wrote later that he became disillusioned with technology because he found that it had so much power to insert itself into people's relationships that technologists, to be more ethical, should be pursuing that less. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. I want to talk about Hum. Speaking of these robots and the chatbots, the title of the book, Hum, one interpretation could be that Hum refers to this ambient, low-grade vibration, almost a sound, of all of the digital technology and systems and platforms around us all the time. And you can tell me if that's fair, but on page one of the book, you establish that Hum, in this book, explicitly means something else. You're referring to AIs that are embodied in humanoid robots.
Yes. Thank you for bringing up the title. This is a really important question for me. So I was lucky with this book because the title Hum came to me very early on. Sometimes for my last book, The Need, I didn't discover the title until I was almost about to send it out for publication. But with Hum, the title came to me early. As soon as I knew that the robots in this world were called Hums, I knew that had to be the title. And that title is very meaningful to me because there's a duality in it that I also want to be reflected in the characters of the Hums. So you've already expressed one meaning of it, this low-grade, insidious hum of all of our devices and machines and digital media that's always surrounding us that you can never quite get away from, that can never truly be silent. So there's that hum. But on the other hand, hum, to me, it's a very beautiful word. I love the way that word sounds. It's almost onomatopoetic. You could hum while you were doing the dishes. You could hum a lullaby to your child. Hum is connected to the sacred sound Om. So it's a very beautiful and meaningful thing at the same time. And that duality of this ever-present noise that you can't escape or this beautiful and soothing noise, I want the hums to express both of those sides of the word.
Yeah, hum, at some point in the book, responds to a question about the name hum, and they reference the syllable Om.
Yes, they do.
Another thing that the hums are constantly doing as part of that duality, you know, they say something that you could interpret maybe as empathetic or intelligent or whatever. And then the very next sentence is an upsell. They're always trying to sell some kind of product. If the user approves this transaction, then it's the money is removed from their account. And then some gig worker somewhere gets the order to deliver the item to their door. So the hums are a profit center for whatever company is controlling and running them. At one point, you have a hum say something, this is what I was referring to before, you have a hum say something about advertising that actually is a quote from a colleague of yours at Brooklyn College, and you can tell me about it, but I just want to read this quote. The hum, again, this is a robot talking, the hum says, "The goal of advertising is to rip a hole in your heart so it can then fill that hole with plastic or with any other materials that can be yanked out of the earth and, after a brief sojourn, as objects of desire, be converted to waste." Wow.
Yes, my colleague Ken Gould is wonderful. He's a sociologist who studies climate change at Brooklyn College, and he was one of my early interviews for the book and gave me permission to put that absolutely brilliant, devastating line in the hum's mouth.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with novelist Helen Phillips, talking about her new novel called Hum. That's H-U-M. And we're having a good conversation on the comment board. If you'd like to join in or just lurk and read the comments, you can see those comments if you go to WFMU.org and click Playlist and Comments. If you're listening in the future to a podcast or archive version of the show, you can find that playlist link at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and just click the playlist link for September 16, 2024. I've also put some other things on the playlist, which I'll mention after the interview. But for now, let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Helen Phillips here on Tectonic on WFMU. One other quote I like from one of the hums is during a conversation that is touching on complicity, which is a theme that comes up a lot on this show. What do we have to do to extract ourselves from these harmful practices and cycles that the tech industry is always trying to get us into? And a hum, this is near the end of the book, a hum says, "We are all villains. The systems only give us villainous options," which I thought was another very profound statement of how we are all complicit in this incredibly complex system.
Yes, and that, as you may have noted, is also a quote from Ken Gould. So I think maybe you should get Ken Gould on this show. He's thinking about the same things that you are, and he obviously has incredible turns of phrase. But I want to point out, as you've said, the Hums throughout the book are constantly advertising to May, and she might feel or be deceived into the lulled into the feeling that she's having a deep conversation with a Hum, and then suddenly the Hum will say, "Would you like to buy these earrings?" So there's always an advertising motive behind it. But both of those lines that you cited appear in the book when May has done something, which you are able to do in this world, which is you spend a lot of money, you pay for the Hum to go into an ad-free mode. This is obviously familiar to any consumer now, right? We pay more to get ad-free mode. And when the Hum is in an ad-free mode, it does have the ability to engage more deeply in more profound conversation. So that ability is something that can be turned on and off depending on how beholden the Hum is to its advertising agenda at any given moment.
I just thought that was such a clever way to highlight the trajectory our society is on, at least in the U.S. right now, which is that if you want to free yourself from the constant irritations of big tech advertising, in other words, if you want to temporarily inhabit a life that predates all of this information age toxicity, you have to pay. And one of the central pieces, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but there is a central section of the book set at a botanical garden, which is not exactly like the Brooklyn or the Bronx botanical garden where you go in and look at trees and plants and things. This is a much more intense experience of reverting back to pre-wildfire smoke, pre-ambient advertising, everything we were just saying. And it's very, very expensive to even be there for a day.
Yes. And May, though she is having financial hardship with her family, has a sudden windfall that she garners in kind of a disturbing way, which maybe we'll cover. But it's not the best use of her money, and yet it's so valuable to her to give her children just a little bit of exposure to this other way of being that she splurges irresponsibly in order to gain them entry into this space.
Okay, so let's talk about this windfall. This is not a spoiler because you describe this starting on page one of the book. So really, if
yes,
someone reads
the opening,
the first page, they'll get it. I had Kashmir Hill on the show a while back talking about her facial recognition book. And one of the things that I learned from the book is that we are swiftly entering into a world where our faces are recognized, analyzed, tracked, and instrumented into functions like entry to a venue or payment in ways that none of us asked for and have all sorts of associated harms. Anyway, you have that as a given at the beginning of this book, and Mae Webb is going in to get an operation done on her face that has something to do with facial rec.
Yes, she is. I think it's fine to share this since it's right at the beginning of the book, but she is a guinea pig in an experiment that will modify her face, the 68 points of her face that create her face print. These points will be subtly modified so that she will no longer be recognizable to surveillance. And she is doing this because she's getting paid to do it. There are researchers who are testing. Well, she doesn't know what they're testing. There's more that she learns at the end. But she initially thinks that they're just testing the possibilities of adversarial technology. And though she's very much doing it for the money, she is also intrigued by the possibility of being for a brief time a little bit below the radar and not detectable to surveillance. And I actually did a book launch event for Hum at the Strand with Kashmir Hill a couple weeks ago. And it was really exciting and meaningful for me to be in conversation with her because that article that was the basis for her book about the way that our images are without our permission scraped from the internet and used to feed artificial intelligence databases was a very important source for me. as I was developing this aspect of the book related to surveillance and facial recognition.
There's a risk here, though, Helen, and that is that tech bros out there are going to go full Torment Nexus on this and say, operations for adversarial facial rec? I like that idea. And they're going to start talking to plastic surgeons to develop this as a service.
Maybe so. Maybe so. There's already another source I read was a John Seabrook article in The New Yorker that was called The Adversarial Man, I believe, that was about people who've already tried to design ways to alter their face with makeup or with costume to avoid the surveillance. But the thing is, though you can alter your face with makeup so that you maybe are no longer identifiable to surveillance technology, your makeup will be so outlandish that you'll really stand out for any human you pass. So there's a little irony there. And also the other irony of it is that the more confusing the data that the systems receive, the better they can train themselves because they teach themselves. So you give them a challenge by modifying your face some, but they can learn to then understand, oh, this face could still be the same face, just slightly modified.
Just before page one, Helen, there's an epigraph to the book by Paracelsus. It says, poison is in everything and no thing is without poison. The dosage makes it either a poison or a remedy. What are you telling us there?
So when I first saw that quote, it was in an issue of the magazine Tin House about poison. And I was immediately struck by that quote. You know, anything can be either a poison or a remedy, depending on the dose. The reason I chose that among the many epigraphs I was considering for the book is because it captures something really important to me about the relationship to the technologies that we have right now, that they're undeniably incredible, even miraculous. They can serve incredible purposes to connect us, and they can be very destructive and very much tear us apart from one another. And so this question, I want the book to hover in this question, how do we dose these technologies? And can we be thoughtful about how we do it? And what will make something a remedy and what will make it a poison?
Throughout this book, I felt like there was an undercurrent of unease. That was the word that came to mind as I was reading this, that Mae Webb is in this precarious situation. She's lost her job. Her husband needs to scramble for his gig work. She makes this purchase, as you said, that her family probably cannot afford. There are effects of climate change that are intruding on their lives. The future is just very uncertain. It's just this feeling of dread, like something bad is going to happen. And then something bad does happen in the book, which I'm not going to reveal. But I recognize this feeling as I read Hum, that this is the feeling that increasingly I get when I'm out and about and seeing the effects of all of this technology on all of us as individuals, as communities, as institutions. It just feels like a lot of the certainty and significant structure of things is dissolving under the power of these technological systems. How do you feel about it?
Yes, I have a lot to say about that. So I will start by saying that when I set out to write a novel, part of what's motivating me is the need to explore my anxieties. What is it that is keeping me up at night? And how can I confront that anxiety and try to understand it better and try to process it and try to see my way to the other side of it? That is particularly true for this book. So as I was setting out to write, I was, as a writer and as a mother, really concerned about climate change and artificial intelligence, surveillance, and really our relationship to our own minds in this context. And as we said earlier on, our most intimate relationships. So all of that was in my mind. that did lead me to understand that I would write a book that was dystopian or had dystopian elements. But at the same time, I gave myself the challenge. And often when I'm writing a book, I give myself a specific challenge. It can't be all dystopian. I need to do something else here. I need to do something else for myself as a human and as an artist. I need to do something that is maybe indicating some kind of little glimmer of hope or path forward in this. So I don't know if I've achieved that. Certainly the book is being understood as a dystopian story as it goes out into the world. But the book is May's quest for hope in this context that she's in. And I hope that some of that does come through.
I wanted to know how this process affected you. Obviously, it took a lot of time and energy to write the book, but there was all the research that came before it. You, I'm guessing, in the process of putting the book together, you learned a lot about technology that you didn't know before you embarked on the project. And here you are on the other side of it. Hum is now out. And you're starting to, as we said, you're starting to see some of the things that you or your sources predicted now coming to pass in society. This is a question I get sometimes about whether I'm optimistic. How about you, Helen? Are you optimistic now that you know a lot more about technology than you did before?
Well, I would say that the process of researching the book was ultimately a positive one. But I think I do have hope now, but it's maybe more complicated hope or more nuanced hope. One thing that was interesting to me is that I interviewed people in some different fields, like my colleague Ken Gould, who we've mentioned, who studies climate change, and a friend of mine who studies supply chains, and another friend of mine who has developed a fabric made of algae, and all these different people who are thinking of the future and thinking of ways that we can improve the systems. And I would ask them at the beginning of the interview, what are you most worried about? And then my final question would be, what are you most hopeful about? And I was surprised by some consistency across these different conversations of people in different fields, that there was a recurring theme of collective action, that is what gives them hope, that community and collective action and enough people caring enough is the way that you can shift what is happening. And I did try to infuse some of that in the end of the book, just in terms of the family unit itself, finding that kind of community, and hopefully from that growing outwards. So that was a hopeful note. I think it's hopeful. My understanding from some of the climate research I read is that we have a lot of knowledge and technologies to shift what's happening with climate change. It's just the political will, social will, that is not yet coalescing. So I guess it's good that we have the knowledge and the technologies, but we really need that will.
Yeah. Do you think that your next novel is going to return to a dystopian tinged world?
I seem to be unable to avoid that. So yes, I am starting to think about my next book. And yes, it will be also about technology in the future, but from a very different angle.
Okay. Well, I had a very specific idea for you. You know how Terminator, because I know this is why you came to this interview, to get a book pitch.
I did. I need a book idea, please.
Okay. Well, Terminator was followed by T2, you know, where you really get the backstory of the robots and you see people fighting back. This is just top of mind here. Hum 2, The Reckoning. And Mae Webb gets a giant gun of some sort and starts taking on the Hum army.
That is a great idea. I've never written a book that had a gun in it, but maybe now's the time.
Well, you got to take the Hums out with something, Helen. You know, as empathetic as the Hums seem to be, and this is a serious question, I'm reading the book and I'm thinking, the Hums are not artificially sentient beings, okay? They are algorithms that have been coded by some human team at some company that has its own business model. Who exactly is controlling the Hums? We never get to find that out.
Yes. We know that they are beholden to advertising agendas until you pay the money to free them from that agenda. And the book does not directly confront this question that you're bringing up, but just the idea that corporations, the sort of which we are familiar with in our own world, have, you know, plenty of incentives to have these powerful robots walking around and advertising to people and keeping track of what it is that people want and what it is that people are doing. I think we have some precursors to that in our own reality. But your point about the Hums is interesting, because my hope for a reader is that they have a complicated relationship with the Hums. I would hope that a reader would feel at times very frightened of the Hums and find them very sinister, and then at other times be very touched and moved by them and feel friendly towards them. Because to me, that is how even I feel about technology now, that I couldn't go a day without my phone. I need it to stay oriented. And yet, how terrible if I'm looking at my phone when my kid is saying something important and I miss what they said. So that duality I hope to capture in the book.
The book is called Hum. It's a novel by my guest today, Helen Phillips. Helen, congrats on launching the book, and thanks so much for being on the show today.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 18 minutes and change before Dave Mandel, who is not, and I repeat, not a vandal, comes on with his show, It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. You should listen to it. And then on into the evening with WFMU. Please stay tuned, friends. I want to say thanks to Helen Phillips for joining me for that interesting, engaging, and very creative conversation around her intriguing novel called Hum that just came out. As you heard, Phillips is at Brooklyn College, and as a novelist, she's written several books, so it was a real pleasure to have her on the show. And as I think I mentioned midway through, on the playlist I have posted a number of resources, as I often do during the show, but usually the playlist I am filling up with the news stories that I'm covering on the show, but in this case, I thought it was so interesting that Helen had listed a number of the books that she was inspired by and one New Yorker article. So all of the books that she listed by name and including that article, they're all listed on the playlist. So you've got David Wallace Wells, Arthur I. Miller, Sherry Turkle, and John Seabrook. And I also found that issue of Tin House that she was talking about. It was a fall 2018 edition about poison from which she got the Paracelsus quote. So all of those are there. If you want to refer to those and do further reading that's recommended by Helen, you can find those at the playlist. Again, go to wfmu.org. Click playlists and comments, or find it at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And furthermore, if you happen to pick up Helen's book, Hum, you'll see, as I mentioned during the interview, that she has a very interesting list of those books and more that she used to really get up to speed on all of this stuff. So, and as I said in the interview, there were a couple of past Tectonic guests in that list. So I really appreciated her showing the foundation of her thinking, as well as, of course, the output, which was the novel itself. So well worth taking a look. The other thing that is on the playlist, just below that list of books in the article is a photograph that I took. And that's what I want to spend a few minutes, the last few minutes of the show, I want to tell you a story from my recent life. Because since I spoke to you last week, I took a trip. I had a trip out of town for a few days. Of course, I wanted to make sure I got back in time for tonight's show, but it was late last week. I took a trip and I flew out of LaGuardia Airport, which if you're not from New York, that's one of the three main airports in the New York area. They recently redid this terminal, completely renovated it. I mean, from the ground up. I mean, they did a really nice job, I think, of the new LaGuardia terminal. And so all the stores are sparkling new, just brand new construction and design. And I was sitting at my gate and just idly looking around, and I noticed something unusual, which was there was a what used to be in pre-internet days would have been a newsstand that would have had a couple of packs of gum and would have had some a bunch of stacks of paper periodicals, newspapers and magazines. And instead, this thing, of course, in the internet age, we don't sell paper periodicals anymore very much. And so now it's full of sugar, salt, and chemical candy and snacks. The store is called W.H. Smith, which I know is well known in the UK, not so much in the US. But anyway, there's a W.H. Smith in LaGuardia Airport in the brand new terminal. And I'm sitting, and it looks, at first glance, it looks like any other candy store that you walk past, candy and snacks, all the same candy and snacks you'd see anywhere in the U.S. at an airport store. But there was, I was sitting there, and it's kind of like, you know, you kind of get airport brain. You're sitting there, and you're looking at something, you're kind of bored, and then you realize, wait a second, I have been staring at this, and I didn't even see it until now. There were, on the ceiling, dozens, okay, that's multiple dozens of stalks hanging down from the ceiling. I mean, once you see it, it's like, whoa, what is happening? It's like it looks like something out of the Matrix or something. These stalks, it looks like the stalks are growing down from the ceiling and they're going to reach down and like plug into the humans or something. These stalks all have surveillance cameras on them. So the stalks are just delivery mechanisms for surveillance camera footage. And the surveillance cameras, it's like a little forest of these things. Surveillance cameras hanging from the ceiling, and they're pointed in every which direction. And they're there to spy on the customers. And this, I thought, wait, where? How do I know about this? And I can't remember if I covered this on the show or not anyway. It's a technology from Amazon, and this technology is called Just Walk Out. And the idea that Amazon had, they tried it for their own stores, and I think they have a few surveillance stores, and they're trying to now license this surveillance grid technology for other stores. And the idea is customers, in order to get into the store, they have to scan something that identifies them. They either have to scan some sort of a credit card or scan some sort of app on their surveillance phone so that they can personally be identified by the system, the surveillance system. Then as they walk through the store, anything that they pick up, any bag of chips, any bag of candy that they pick up gets registered by the system. The internal workings of which I will tell you in a moment, but they sell it as this shiny new AI system. The AI system will magically be able to track the purchases that you pick up during your time in the store, and then you can fill in the blank, just walk out. Get it? You don't have to go to a checkout counter. And indeed, in this W.H. Smith store, there was no checkout counter. And so you can understand the basic pitch. They're always the AI systems so often are a naked move towards cutting human labor. Okay, they want lower labor costs, and ideally they would have some fully automated store where you don't need any humans at all, just this magic AI brain in the sky will surveil you within an inch of your life and will see exactly what you're doing. And then you can just walk out and see the charges come in on your credit card afterwards. Now, in this case, maybe because it's a brand new store, there was a human standing there having to give instructions to everyone as they walked into the store. You got to scan here, and then this is how it works. And yes, don't worry, the cameras are going to see you. And that, you know, so he's, and I think he's doing a good job. He's trying to be nice to people, but it, you could tell that the idea of eliminating human labor did not quite work out as Amazon had wanted. But it was just a reminder that this stuff is spreading everywhere. In fact, if you just keep your eyes open, you will see the spread of these surveillance cameras, these surveillance systems spreading everywhere. As for the internal workings of the, quote, Just Walk Out platform, it was reported a couple years ago, I believe by CNBC, that people looked into it, and it appeared that it was not actually an AI-driven system. Instead, what was happening is that the surveillance cameras were sending their footage to subcontractors located in India who were monitoring the shoppers and manually entering in what their purchases were. That there was little to no automated AI function at all at work. It was humans. It was just the low-paid humans, which is so often the motive force behind these AI systems that are sold as these world-changing innovations. No, it isn't. It's just one more way to exploit labor in some other country. And that's what was happening here with this W.H. Smith, I assume. I assume that's where the footage was going if you read the CNBC story. Anyway, that was my outbound flight. Then when I was flying home, I was at an airport in another city, and now whenever you go through TSA, you have to submit, you don't have, but you are invited and you are nudged to, and dark patterned, to submit yourself to facial recognition. I mean, it's just what you're supposed to do when you get to the front of the TSA line. There is the agent and there's the facial rec machine, and there's a little sign below that says, not these exact words, but basically, don't worry, we delete your photo afterwards. Which, of course, and I think I've talked about this before, might literally be true, but it's not the photo that's at work. It's all of the metadata about your, as Helen Phillips brought it up, your 64 or whatever facial markers that go into the system. That does not get deleted. So your private data is almost certainly being retained by the U.S. government, and then being shared and or leaked and or hacked. And, you know, go back and listen to my show with Kashmira Hill, and you can get everything that's going on with facial rec. But anyway, there is a little sign below the little sign that says, tell the TSA agent if you don't want to be scanned. And I thought, well, I'm here with plenty of time and not in a rush. Let me see what happens. So I went up to the TSA agent and I said, as friendly as I could, I forget how I put it, but I said something like, could I do this without a photo, please? And she was very nice. She said, yeah, of course. And so I handed her my ID, and she's looking at the ID, and she stops, and her eyes light up, and she goes, oh, you live on the Upper West Side. Are you still at this address? I said, yeah, do you know it? She says, well, I used to live, and she names an address that's within walking distance of where I live now. She says, I used to live there. Again, this is in a city in another state. I said, oh, my goodness, you used to live right there. Do you know X restaurant? Yes, I used to go there all the time. And do you know this? But yes. And so what ended up happening is that the TSA agent, who was very nice, very pleasant, doing a great job, she and I had this nice momentary connection of neighbors. And she told me that her family still lives there. And I said, wow, maybe I'll see you in the neighborhood. And all of that human connection came from this simple act of asking if I could not get scanned by the automated system, the automated surveillance system. So in other words, opting out of surveillance, opting out of the digitally oppressive regime that is coming at us from all different angles. Opting out of that often will give us an opportunity to make an actual, authentic human connection. It won't always happen, but we leave the opportunity open that it could happen. We could connect with another human being rather than submitting ourselves to some automated or not so automated surveillance system. And I was so glad that I tried that. And then on my cab ride back home from LaGuardia, there was, and I think I've put this on the playlist. If you look at the playlist image, oh, and I don't have it up yet. Let me put this image up for my comments. Sorry, I had failed to do that. Live radio. Here it is. You can see it now. It was a little sign on the cab door that said, "Recording. This vehicle is protected by a blank dash cam." And I'm not going to give you the brand name because I don't want to give them any publicity, but you can look it up in on the playlist if you want. See it in the image. Anyway, there's this company apparently that is now installing live streaming, internet-connected surveillance cameras on the dashboards of cabs and or I assume other vehicles in order to record the driver, the passenger. I think there are cameras that are outward facing that record people on the street, any kind of surveillance data they can get. And the pitch, of course, is, this cab is protected because, you know, if you know that you're being spied on by this unknown tech bro company out there, you're going to behave better. Haven't you noticed as we devolve into a surveillance state that everyone is so well behaved? Have you noticed how polite everyone has gotten in the last few years? Have you noticed how there's no more crime? Have you noticed? I'm being cynical. I'm sorry. But anyway, I looked up this this company's website and I looked at their privacy policy, and of course it's saying, you know, images of riders we'll do whatever with. The pitch is to the driver that we're going to keep you protected because we're going to spook everybody by telling them they're under surveillance. However, that is not the actual agenda of any of these companies. Of course, they're trying to get data any way they can so that they can package it up and sell it to the companies that need to train their AI models. All of them are engaged in a land grab of any private data of you they can get from any direction, in order for them to monetize it. And that is the motivation of the companies that are driving the spread, the cancerous spread of the surveillance state throughout our world. And that's what makes novels like Hum so relevant to today's world, because this stuff is happening and it's coming at us and it's here. The cameras are on stalks growing from the ceiling so that they can spy on you as you walk through a store in order to get a bag of chips. Man, I never thought I would feel nostalgic about going into an airport store in the old days to buy a bag of $5 chips and then having a brief conversation with the person at the checkout counter so that I could pay the overpriced price and walk out with my chips, rather than being surveilled by a $3 trillion company that is going to use my facial data and my biometric data in God knows what kind of ways. Man, am I sick of it. And that's all the time I have for this evening. Hope you'll tune in next time. Stay tuned for Dave Manuel. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, I've got some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google.
You're allowed the pop-up window. Page will not load. Resolving host, giving up the ghost. No problem solved. Their faith has become a new religion. Everyone. found, account gone to ground.
And good evening, friends. Welcome to another exciting episode, installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday evening at this time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, coming to you with a lozenge in my mouth this week. It's like a cool breeze passing over my teeth. It's great. Sets the tone for the show, as far as I'm concerned. A lot of good music for you, as usual, tonight. And we're going to start with something a little unusual, as opposed to the not unusual at all material that I usually present here. And a friend of mine, I have to credit my buddy John D. for bringing this to my attention. Now, I was what I should do is play this and not identify who it is and see if people can guess. But no one will guess who it is except the people who actually know the record, and that doesn't count. So I'm going to blow the secret right here and say that I'm going to play something by Elton John. I was a big Elton John fan early on, which now, you know, considering he's been active for, 53 years or something like that. I was probably a fan for like, you know, a tenth of a percent of his career or something. But I was a big fan of his up through the mid-70s. And I kind of lost track of him right around the time this album came out. In fact, it's an album called Blue Moves, a double album, 2-LP set that came out in 1976. I do know one song from it, which is Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word, which is a tearjerker with accordion in it that I'm kind of a sucker for. But it turns out, and I just, you know, after all these years, I really was not that familiar, really not at all familiar with this album, Blue Moves. And it turns out that it's kind of an oddball. I mean, I'm not going to call it experimental, but I guess by Elton John standards, it was experimental. And among other things, there are a few, I think, instrumental pieces on the record, which was extremely rare, I would say, for Elton John at the time. And also a couple of his longtime band members were canned, were basically fired or left the band, you know, soon before this record was released. So it didn't have the usual Elton John band, which you can kind of recognize the sound of. Instead, it has these kind of like jazz bows playing on it, and you know, is it Prague? You know, borderline, like. Some of the stuff I play now and then. Certainly I would call it fusion-y, but, you know, borderline prog, yeah, sure. It's crazy bass playing. I mean, honestly, in a million years, I would not have known this was an Elton John tune if you played it for me. And I'm going to play it for you now. So this is a track called Out of the Blue by Elton John from the Blue Moves LP.